man drew a pistol and shot them both, then was shot in return by the two officers. A police spokesman said that both officers were wearing ballistic vests and are not seriously injured, and the shooter is at Bellevue Hospital and talking to officers. He is expected to recover. Mocker called Jake Herman on his cell.
Yeah? Have you heard the news? Barrington is dead?
No, but Svensson is in Bellevue with two gunshot wounds, and he's talking.
Oh, shit.
You'd better not come to work, and don't go home, either.
I'm at home now.
Well, get out of there and call me at mid-morning. I'll deal with the police.
Where am I supposed to go?
Go get some breakfast or something. Just go. Mocker hung up. He drove to his office and parked out back, then let himself into the building and ran to his office. He opened his safe, pulled on some latex gloves, and put his timers and detonators into the box containing the remainder of his explosives, then took it out of the safe and into the alley. He walked 50 yards away and put the box carefully into a neighbor's dumpster, then returned to his office and had a good look around for any trace of the explosives. He went to Jake's office and did the same. Then he went back to his desk and sat down. The police arrived around 8:30. They hammered on the front door, and he raced to open it before they crashed in. "Good morning," he said to the four armed and suited men and two detectives. "Can I help you?"
"Mind if we come in?" a detective asked.
He led them to his office and sat down.
"Now," he said, "what's this all about?"
"Have you listened to the news this morning?"
"I'm afraid not. Is there something I should know about?"
"Do you have two employees named Jacob Herman and Daniel Svensson?"
"Yes, but they aren't in yet. I usually get in before anyone else."
"Do you know their whereabouts?"
Mocker glanced at his watch.
"I suppose they're on their way to work. You're welcome to wait for them. Would you like some coffee?"
"No, thanks, but while we're waiting, let me serve you with this warrant to search the premises."
He handed Mocker the document. Mocker dropped it, unread, on his desk, and spread his hands.
"Please, help yourself," he said. "You don't need a warrant. I'm happy to help."
"Where are your two employees' offices?"
"Mr. Herman's is to your left at the end of the hall. Mr. Svensson is to your right at the other end."
He turned to his men.
"Okay, two of you in each office. We'll take this room."
He turned back to Mocker.
"Stand up."
Mocker stood up, backed away from his desk, and leaned against the wall.
"Let me know if I can help."
The two detectives went methodically through his desk and filing cabinets and asked him to open the safe.
"I'm happy to do so. When do I get to know what this is all about?"
He worked the combination. One detective started on the safe.
"You have permits for all these weapons?"
"In the box on the right side shelf, along with my business license,"
Mocker replied.
"It's like this," the other detective said. "Last night in New York City, a patrol car came across your employee, Svensson, putting tape over his license plate."
"Svensson isn't supposed to be in New York," Mocker said. "He's due here for work, like always."
"Well, he's in Bellevue Hospital instead, with two bullets in him."
"Why would they shoot him?"
"Because he shot them first. Luckily, they were wearing protective gear."
"This is crazy," Mocker said, giving his best performance.
"Svensson is a good man, a decorated veteran of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Well, now he's charged with 2 counts of attempted murder."
"This is insane. What does Svensson have to say?"
A uniform came back.
"The officers are clean of anything that could be of use to us."
"Listen," Mocker said. "It sounds like Svensson went off his rocker. He's had problems with post-traumatic stress disorder going back to his army days. I can't think of any other reason he'd go to New York, shoot two policemen.
We don't know. We were hoping to find some answers here. When did you last speak to Mr. Herman?
Yesterday, when he left work.
I called him on the way to work this morning, but got his voicemail.
He should have been at work an hour and a half ago.
The detective gave him a card. When you hear from Herman, give us a call, and tell him not to go anywhere until we've talked to him.
Mocker took the card.
I hope you'll ask your colleagues in New York to treat Dan Svensson like a wounded veteran instead of a criminal suspect.
We'll pass along the information.
The detectives thanked him for his cooperation and left.
Another 15 minutes passed before Jake Herman called.
Where are you, Jake?
Down the street in a diner.
You know the one.
The cops have already been here and torn the place apart, but they didn't find anything.
I don't want to talk on the phone, Jake said. We need to meet.
Where?
I don't know. Someplace they'd never look for me.
I can think of a place, Mocker said. It belongs to Ed Rawls. But he's at his house in Maine. It's an hour, hour and a half from here.
He gave him directions.
If you get there before I do, break in. But disable the alarm first. I'll get there as fast as I can.
Okay.
Mocker's secretary walked in.
This place is a mess, she said. I have to go out, Mocker said. Please tidy up. Jake and Dan won't be in today.
When will you be back?
Tomorrow, the next day, maybe. We've got a new client.
Mocker went into the alley, removed the explosives from the neighbor's dumpster, and put them in the trunk of his car. He chose weapons from the safe, then got the car started and headed south. 54. Jake Herman got to the house first. He found the junction box for the alarm system and disconnected it. Then he picked the lock on the back door, went in, unlocked the other doors, and made himself some coffee in the kitchen. The phone rang, but it soon stopped. He liked the house, particularly the study, and he made himself at home in there with the Washington Post and the New York Times, which he had picked up at the diner. Mocker, using a burner phone, called Jake's cell from the road.
Yeah? Where are you?
At the house.
Pretty nice.
I thought you'd been there before. We had the place under surveillance for a few days a while back.
Nope, I didn't get that duty.
Did you disconnect the alarm?
I did.
What are you doing now?
Reading the papers and having some of our host's coffee. There's no food in the house, so if you're planning to be here for a while, you'd better pick up some groceries.
Okay, I'll do that. See you in an hour or so.
Mocker hung up and turned into a shopping center, where there was a supermarket. Half an hour later, he was back on the road with a trunk full of food and drink. Stone was at his desk when Joan buzzed.
Ed Rawls for you on one.
Hello, Ed.
Morning, Stone. Anything unusual happening there?
Well, let's see. In the middle of the night, there was a gun battle in front of my house, and the perpetrator is in Bellevue with a couple of slugs in him. Turns out he had planted a bomb outside before he was arrested, but we got that taken care of before it could go off.
Sounds like Mocker.
Sounds exactly like Mocker. The perp's car was registered to his Virginia security company, and the Arlington police have searched his offices looking for Jake Herman, his number one man, who was implicated by the shooter. Mocker was in his office in Arlington, but he's probably on the run by now.
Funny you should mention that, Rawls said. I got a call from the alarm system monitor for my Virginia house. Someone has disconnected the alarm.
I'll call Dino and see that the local police are notified. My house is in the country, and the local sheriff's office is understaffed. They don't think much of domestic alarm system calls, since 9 out of 10 are homeowners who have entered the wrong code or otherwise fucked it up.
What do you want to do, then?
I'm headed to Virginia this morning anyway. It's getting too cold for me in Maine. I was going to drive, but I think I'll charter a light airplane from the Rockland Airport. If I start now, I can be down there in, say, 3 hours.
You'd better go armed if Jake Herman is in your house.
Where do you think Mocker is? Ed asked.
No idea. I'll see what Dino knows and get back to you. Stone dialed the number.
Bichetti.
It's Stone. Can you get another fix on Mocker's cell phone?
Hang on.
Dino put him on hold for a minute, then came back.
He's still in Virginia, but he's moved south to a spot not far from the workplace of your buddy Lance Cabot.
That sounds like Ed Rawl's house.
Is Ed down there?
No, but he's headed that way. Thanks. Stone hung up and called Rawls. Rawls was packing when Stone called.
Hello? Ed, Dino's got a fix on Mocker, and he's at a location not far from Langley. That sound familiar?
You bet your sweet ass it does. I gotta run.
He called the airport and ordered up their Cessna 182, then finished packing. He called a local cab to take him to the airport. Stone called Dino.
Bichetti.
I just got a call from Ed Rawls. Somebody has disconnected the alarm at his house in Virginia. I told him about your hit on Mocker's phone, and he's on the way down there. I don't want him to walk in on them. Can you call the cop shop down there and get them to check the house?
Listen, I can't call out the local gendarmerie in some podunk place in another state just because Ed Rawls has a hair up his ass. Does he have a security system?
Yes, and it went off this morning.
If they can get an alarm anomaly, somebody'll check it out. I'm not going to get involved.
Do the Arlington police know where Mocker is now?
He was in his office an hour ago when they left.
Okay, thanks. Stone hung up and Googled Mocker's company, then called.
EM Services, a woman said.
Eric Mocker, please.
He's out at the moment. Who's calling?
A friend. When do you expect him back?
It may be a day or two, she said.
Thanks. Stone hung up and called Rawls back.
Rawls, Mocker's office says he's gone for a couple of days. Does he know about your house?
He certainly does. He had surveillance on it for several days.
What's the nearest airport?
I'm flying into Manassas. They're picking me up in half an hour to go to Islesboro Airport.
Tell you what, I'll fly into Manassas, too. Meet me there.
Okay. Whoever lands first can just wait.
Right. Are you armed?
You bet your ass.
I'm not licensed down there.
The rural law tends to look kindly on that sort of thing if you're licensed anywhere at all.
Okay, Ed. I'll see you when I see you. They hung up.
Stone buzzed Joan.
Yes, boss?
I've got to go somewhere. Please call the airport and have the airplane brought up and refueled pronto, and tell Fred I need a ride.
Will do.
Stone hung up and went upstairs to pack a bag. Fred drove him to the airport, and he filed a flight plan for Manassas on the way. The airplane was on the ramp when he arrived. He did his usual pre-flight inspection, then ran through the cockpit checklist and got a clearance. That done, he started the engines, finished his checklist, and got permission to taxi. There were a few corporate jets ahead of him, and it took another half hour to get off the ground. The flight time was a little over an hour,
so he stayed fairly low, at 20,000 feet, instead of climbing to 41,000. It burned more fuel down there, but it saved time on ascent and descent. The weather was clear at both ends, so he anticipated no delays. 55. Jake read one of Rawls's books for a while, but felt antsy. It was nice outside, so he went for a little walk. The first nip of autumn was in the air, and there was a hint of color in the trees around the house. As he strolled around the ample backyard, he noticed a pile of dirt behind the garage. Closer inspection revealed a brand new propane tank set in the hole and an old rusty one on the ground beside it. The new tank appeared to be connected, and the heat was on in the house. A backhoe stood beside the hole. Apparently, the tank had been installed, and the backhoe operator had left until the plumber arrived to make the connection. He strolled on until he came to a barbed wire fence that seemed to separate Rawls's property from the farm beyond. A few dairy cattle grazed beyond that. He felt a hunger pang and wished Marker would hurry up. On his way back, he inspected the garage, found it unlocked, and an old Mercedes inside. He thought it would be a good idea to get his own car out of sight, so he moved it into the garage and closed the doors. Marker was nearly to the house when his cell rang. Yes, it was his secretary.
Someone called for you half an hour ago.
Who?
He said he was a friend, wouldn't leave a name.
If he calls again, give him my cell number.
As you wish.
He hung up. That wouldn't have been the police, since they had already visited, and a client would have given his name. He considered Barrington as a possibility, but dismissed it as being too far-fetched. He drove on toward his destination. Stone got the Manassas automated weather. The wind was from the south at 10 knots, so he called the tower and requested runway 16 and set the airplane down there. He rolled out and taxied back to the FBO, expecting Rawls to come out to greet him, but he didn't show. Probably still in the air. Inside, he requested fuel and hangar space and rented a car. Half an hour later, a Cessna 182 rolled up to the FBO, cut its engine, and Rawls got out. Stone met him on the ramp and put his bags into the car along with his own. Rawls headed inside for the head, then came back and got into the car. "I'll need directions," Stone said, and Rawls gave them. "What's your plan when we get there, Ed?"
"Don't have one," Rawls replied. "I don't think we'll just walk in, though. Why don't we stop for a late lunch, then take our time? I'd rather approach the place after dark. If Herman is there, he'll have a light on."
"Makes sense." Rawls guided Stone to a country restaurant, and they had a leisurely lunch.
"We could pay Lance Cabot a surprise call," Rawls said. "The agency is 10 minutes from here, and we go right past it."
"I don't think Lance and I have anything in particular to say to each other right now." He told Rawls about Lance's disinterest in connecting the CIA explosives to Eric Macher.
"That sounds like Lance," Rawls said. "There was nothing in it for him, so he said no."
Marker pulled up to the house in the late afternoon. He didn't see Jake's car, so he approached the house with caution. Jake saw him through a window and opened a door to admit him.
"Where's your car?" Marker asked. "I put it in the garage." "Is there room for mine?" "No. Rawls's car is taking up the other space."
Marker parked next to the house.
"Have you had a look around?"
"Yeah," Jake said. "I took a walk."
"Anything unusual going on?"
There's a backhoe parked behind the garage waiting to bury a new propane tank, apparently just installed. So tomorrow somebody might turn up to fill the hole. I don't think he'll need to speak to us. Did you bring food?
Yep.
Booze, too. I could use a drink.
I could use one, too, Jake said, and something to eat.
They went inside the house, collecting Mocker's bag on the way. Jake saw the explosives in the box in the trunk.
Why did you bring the plastique?
I wanted to get it out of the office.
The cops have searched it once, but I moved it to a dumpster. You never know when they'll come back.
What did they say about Dan Svensson?
That he's expected to recover.
Did they mention the bomb?
No.
That must mean it didn't go off. What time were they at the office?
They left a little before 10.
So the bomb might still have gone off.
I don't think so, Mocker said. I had the satellite radio news on the way down here, and there was no mention of it.
They went into the kitchen, and Jake heated up a can of chili while they sipped a scotch. Stone and Rawls cruised slowly past the house as the sun was going down and saw Mocker's Mercedes.
"What does Mocker drive?" Ed asked.
"A Mercedes S550, just like that one," Stone replied.
They drove on past.
56.
Stone, directed by Ed Rawls, found a spot to park in some high weeds within sight of the house. Stone left the satellite radio on a jazz station so they wouldn't have to talk, but Rawls wanted to talk anyway.
"This is like old times in my younger days with the agency," he said. "Except I would be on my belly in the grass instead of sitting in a comfortable chair and listening to good jazz from the sky."
"Did you like those days?" Stone asked, just to keep him going.
"I did," Rawls replied. "In fact, I loved them. I was serving my country and at the same time venting my hatred of the Soviets and the harm they were causing in the world. Every time we hurt them, I felt genuine satisfaction."
"What about later, when you were running agents instead of being run?"
"Running others was harder than being run. The only safety I could give them was in the planning. Once they were out in the field, all I could do was worry, and I did."
"Did many of them not come back?"
"A few. I could name their names and tell you their records, which I memorized. We hardly ever got to bury them. They're just stars on a wall at Langley, not even their names.
You said you'd heard of Mocker while you were still in harness. What did you hear?"
"I told you some of it, a propensity for violence, whether called for or not. He'd shoot the opposition if he had the chance. It caused a backlash from the Soviets and the East Germans that did not react to our benefit. For that, I hate the son of a bitch to this day."
"Do you mean to kill him tonight?" Stone asked.
"If he gives me an excuse that will work with the cops. I'm not willing to go to jail for it."
"Are you going to back me?"
"If I can," Stone replied.
"That's very reassuring," Rawls said sarcastically. "After all, he's tried to kill me a couple of times. Tried hard, too. I just got lucky."
"I should think that would be reason enough just to put two in his head," Rawls said. "What does it take to get you riled enough to do something about it?"
"I haven't figured that out yet," Stone replied.
"Well, you'd better think on it, because if we get within range of these two, I think we can count on rounds coming our way."
"That would certainly call for a response," Stone said.
They sat quietly for a while, waiting for dark. Rawls finally spoke again, and his voice was without its hard edge.
"You know, I've known a lot of people in my life,
Still know a lot of them. But I think you're the only friend I've got.
Why do you think that is? Stone asked, genuinely curious.
Kate used to be my friend, Rawls said. I was her mentor, and I was a good one, too. But when I had my trouble, she took great personal offense, and we weren't friends anymore.
Stone knew about that.
Since that time, you are the only person who has laid it on the line for me, and I want you to know I'm grateful for that.
You're welcome, but let's not overstate the case.
I'm not overstating nothing. Who else would be with me here right now?
Stone didn't have an answer for that.
They were silent for a while, and Stone began to doze a bit.
Sometime later, he wasn't sure how long, Rawls poked him in the ribs.
What? Stone asked. A light just went on in the house, Rawls said. In my study, I think.
Nothing else?
Nothing else.
Then that would mean they're both in your study, wouldn't it?
No, Rawls said. That would mean that at least one of them is in my study. The other could be upstairs, asleep, or napping on the living room sofa. Let's drift down there and see.
As the car began to move, an outdoor light came on behind the house.
Marker got up from the living room sofa, where he had been napping, and making decisions.
He went to the study door, where Jake was reading.
Jake?
Yep.
Come show me this backhoe out back.
What for?
I'm curious about something.
What?
Show me and I'll tell you, if it means something.
Jake put down his book and stood up.
All right, follow me.
He took out a flashlight, led the way to the rear of the house and out the door. As his foot touched the back steps, Mocker turned on the outside light.
Easier to see, he said.
Jake led the way behind the garage, then switched on his light to illuminate the shadows.
You know how to run a backhoe, Jake? Mocker asked.
Yeah, I worked construction in summers during college. I can handle most gear. We shouldn't cover it up, though. Somebody will be back to do that.
Right.
They were standing on the edge of the pit, looking at the new tank.
Let me have your flashlight for a minute, Mocker said.
Sure,
Jake said, handing it over. Mocker shot Jake in the back of the head. He crumpled, then fell into the pit alongside the tank. He was still moving. Mocker reached out and put one foot on the tank, his other still on the edge of the pit, straddling Jake. Being careful not to hit the tank, Mocker put another round into Jake's head. He crumpled, relaxed, and fell deeper into the pit below the tank. If you weren't looking for it, Mocker thought, you wouldn't see it. Still, he had to be sure. Coasting down a small hill with the windows down, Stone and Ed heard the first shot and saw the flash from the rear of the garage. Then they heard the second shot.
"Somebody's in that pit with my new propane tank," Rawls said.
"Pit?"
"I ordered a new tank. The plumber has hooked it up, but they haven't finished the job yet. The hole still has to be filled."
"Which one do you think is in the pit?" Stone asked.
"It would be unlike Mocker to be," Ed replied.
Using Jake's flashlight, Mocker found a shovel. He holstered his weapon, held the flashlight in his teeth, and began shoveling dirt into the crevice where Jake's body lay. It only took a few shovelfuls to make the body invisible. He returned the shovel to its original position and trudged back toward the house. He needed a night's sleep before he returned to Arlington. He was relieved to have Jake out of the way. It left him in the clear, and the trail from the New York incident would stop with Jake. They might have their suspicions, but they wouldn't have the evidence.
He would send someone in a day or two to pick up Jake's company car. 57. Stone had passed the house now. He made a U-turn, and Ed told him to park in the weeds again.
"He's going to need sleep," Ed said. "Let's let him settle in a while."
"And then what?" Stone asked.
"Then we can capture us a murderer," Ed replied. "Whichever one it is, then we call the cops."
"You're still making this up as you go along, aren't you?" Stone asked.
"Yep. Let's get a little sleep ourselves."
He laid his head against the seat back and seemed instantly asleep. Stone dozed too, and when he awoke, the moon had set, and it was pitch dark, no lights in the house. As he shifted his weight, Rawls woke too.
"Ah, good," Ed said. "I feel better rested now."
"What's your plan?" Stone asked.
"I want to get a look inside that Mercedes," Rawls said.
"What if it's locked?"
"Who would lock his car out here in the wilderness?"
He got out of the car, closed the door softly, and, followed by Stone, crossed the road and walked toward the house. At the entrance to the driveway, which was paved, Rawls stopped and took off his shoes, and Stone followed suit.
"Don't use your flashlight unless you have to," Rawls said.
He walked silently up the driveway, stopped, and signaled for Stone to wait. Then he went to the driver's side door of the Mercedes, shone his light inside briefly, and the trunk lid opened without a sound. Rawls walked to the rear of the car, set his shoes inside the trunk, then played his light around the interior. He seemed to open a box. Then he set down his light and worked for perhaps a minute at something. Then he switched off the light, picked up his shoes, silently closed the trunk lid, and joined Stone.
"Let's go have a look behind the garage," Rawls said.
Stone followed him, keeping the garage between them and the house. Ed waited until they were standing on the edge of the dark pit before he switched on his flashlight.
"Well," Ed said, holding the beam steady, "you wouldn't notice unless you were looking for him, would you?"
"No," Stone replied, "you wouldn't."
"Let's go back to our car," Rawls said.
Stone followed him back to the road, where they put their shoes back on and walked the few yards to the car.
"Why aren't we rousting Mocker?" he asked.
"Well," Rawls said, "I'd rather not tiptoe into the house and up the stairs to the bedroom where he's likely sleeping with a gun next to him. It's an old house, and it's creaky in places. I'd rather wait until he comes downstairs in the morning and gets into his car. I'll give him the option of running."
"I'll take the back seat," Stone said, opening the door and crawling in.
He was shortly fast asleep. Stone was awakened at sunrise by the starting of the car. He sat up as Rawls put it into gear and drove the 50 yards that separated them from the house. To Stone's surprise, Rawls parked on the opposite side of the road at the entrance to the driveway, leaving it clear. Ed switched off the engine.
"Now," he said.
Stone got out of the car, peed into a ditch, then got into the front passenger seat. There was no traffic anywhere.
"Now what?" he asked. "Mr. Mocker has stirred," Ed said. "I caught a whiff of coffee on the air. He'll be leaving soon."
"Why do you think that?"
"Because he won't want to be here when the backhoe operator arrives, in case the fellow should notice that there's a corpse in the hole with the tank. Mocker will stop somewhere nearby where he has a view and make sure the operator does his work and leaves without the cops arriving. That done, he'll drive home a free man with no evidence of anything against him. Then, in due course,
he'll find a way to murder you. I'm tired of people trying to murder me, Stone said.
Well, he's screwed up 3 times. Fourth time, lucky, I reckon.
He'll take the greatest care next time.
You're very encouraging, Stone said.
Not to worry, Ed said. He won't get far.
Then he'll have a terrible accident.
I don't understand, Stone said. You will in a little while.
By the way, I think you should keep your weapon in its holster.
You won't need help?
I'll have all the help I need, and I and my weapon are legal in Virginia.
Whatever you say, Stone said. He was hungry. He started thinking about eggs and bacon.
Here we go, Rawls shouted. He began getting out of the car.
Stone looked up to see Mocker, carrying a small suitcase, come out of the kitchen door and start for his car. He didn't seem to notice the car parked across the road, with a man leaning against it. Mocker got into the Mercedes, made a U-turn, drove to the head of the driveway, and stopped. Now he was staring straight ahead at Ed Rawls.
"Does he know you?" Stone asked.
"Maybe, maybe not," Rawls replied.
"Stop! Murder!" he whispered aloud.
Then Mocker saw Stone.
"What's your plan, Ed?"
"I'm gonna put a few rounds into the man's trunk, where he has stored 2 bricks of gelignite."
"I've got bad news for you, Ed."
"What's that?"
"You can fire all the bullets you like into gelignite, and they won't ignite it."
"We'll see," Ed said.
Mocker decided it was time to move. He started a right turn into the road and accelerated. Ed began firing at the lower right of his trunk. The 4th round bore fruit. Fortunately, the car was far enough away to protect the shooter and his friend, because the explosion was like what Stone thought would be produced by a missile from a passing fighter plane. Assisted by the fuel in the tank, the car erupted into an enormous fireball, and the noise pinned their ears back, and the shockwave knocked them down. Small bits of the car rained down around them, some of them flaming. The 2 men got to their feet.
"You're right, Stone," Ed said. "A bullet into the plastique wouldn't ignite it. But if there were 6 detonators plugged into it, and the bullet struck one of those, then that, as you can see, would do the job."
"I can't bring myself to disagree," Stone said, brushing himself off.
Ed reached into the car and turned on the emergency blinkers.
"Why don't we go into the house, have some breakfast, call the cops, and get our stories straight?"
58. Stone and Rawls sat across the kitchen table from a Captain Sawyer, chief of the Virginia State Police Bureau of Criminal Investigation, who looked tired and a little baffled.
"Mr. Rawls," Sawyer said, "I have to tell you, in 30 years of serving in law enforcement, that is the most complicated story I have ever heard."
"That's the way it happened," Rawls replied. "Sometimes life is complicated."
"Life is usually complicated," Sawyer replied, "but not that complicated."
He looked at Stone, who had remained mostly mute.
"Mr. Barrington, is that the way you saw it happen?"
"Captain, I'm Mr. Rawls's attorney. I wouldn't let him lie to a law enforcement officer."
"Well, I spoke to Commissioner Bachetti in New York, as you suggested, and he backs you up about the threat constituted by Jacob Herman and Eric Mocker. After hearing about them, I'm not surprised there were explosives in the trunk of Mocker's car."
"I was surprised," Rawls said. "I was aiming at his right rear tire, not his trunk."
Stone kicked him under the table.
"But that's all I've got to tell you," Rawls said.
Stone breathed a sigh of relief. "Lieutenant," Sawyer said to the uniformed officer leaning against a kitchen counter. I'm satisfied with Mr. Rawls and Mr. Barrington's accounts of what happened here. You may remove Mr. Herman's body to the state crime lab. Have you found any of Mr. Marker? A few charred pieces of bone, the lieutenant replied. I guess everything else was just vaporized. I'm not surprised, Sawyer said. That must have been some explosion. We got 911 calls from miles around. Most folks thought there'd been a plane crash. I'm not surprised, Rawls said. Sawyer slapped his palms on the table. Well, I'm out of here, Lieutenant. You got anything else? That's it for us, Captain.
The officers shook hands with Stone and Ed and filed out of the house. A moment later, the last of their vehicles had left the property.
I'm glad that's over, Stone said.
Then he jumped as there came a knock on the door. Rawls answered it and found a man in work clothes standing there.
"Morning, Mr. Rawls," he said. "Is it okay now if I fill up that hole and get my backhoe out of here?"
"Go right ahead," Rawls said, "and send me a bill."
He came back and sat down at the table.
"I thought you were going to talk us right into prison," Stone said. "I've always been a good explainer. I wish I had a transcript of what you said, in case they ask me any more questions."
Rawls removed a small recorder from his shirt pocket.
"I'll send you a transcript," he said.
He got up, went to a drawer, and came back with a thick envelope. "And speaking of manuscripts, here's mine. There are letters from three publishers inside. They saw one of the earliest ones we disseminated a while back. Will you call them and get me a deal?"
Stone picked up the envelope and weighed it. "It seems to have grown a bit.
I added a few things."
"Sure, Ed, I'll get it done. Now, I've got some calls to make, and then do you mind if I borrow a bed? I need a few hours of sleep."
"Top of the stairs to your left," Ed said. "In fact, I'm headed up to my bed now."
He got up and headed for the stairs.
Stone conferenced in Mike Freeman and Charlie Fox and gave them an abbreviated version of Ed's account to the police.
"It's okay to pull all your people out of the Carlson Clinic, Mike," Stone said. "I'll let them know."
"Done," Mike said, "and congratulations on a good outcome."
Stone called Paul Carlson and told him he would shortly be free of security guards. Carlson seemed to speak a little hesitantly.
Stone, have you, read your emails this morning?"
"No, Paul. I've been kind of busy."
"Well, Marissa has decided to stay on in Stockholm and run our clinic there. She'll explain everything in her email."
"Thank you, Paul," Stone said, because he couldn't think of anything else to say.
"And thank you, Stone, for everything you've done for us."
The two men hung up, and Stone went to his email. There it was.
"Dear Stone, I have to tell you I'm staying on in Stockholm for the foreseeable future. I'm needed to run the clinic here. I have to tell you, too, that I've hired a childhood friend, a brilliant surgeon, to come aboard as chief of surgery. He and I have rekindled an old romance, and we will be married here in a few weeks. I'm sorry not to have been able to tell you this in person, but you weren't answering your phone. I'll treasure the memory of our time together. Fondly, Marissa."
His shoulders slumped, and he realized he had been half expecting this. He'd just have to get over it. He was about to call Joan when his phone rang. Private call.
"Hello?"
"Hi, it's Holly."
Stone brightened.
"Hi there. How are you?"
"Very well, thanks. Listen, I know this is short notice, but Kate is in town overnight from the campaign trail, and she and Will want to talk to you about something. Can you fly down here and stay the night in the family quarters?" As it happens, I'm down here already, at Ed Rawls's house, near Langley, and I'd love to.
Wonderful. I've got to run right now, but we'll catch up later. Use the West Wing entrance, and they'd like you there around 6 o'clock.
See you then.
He hung up, feeling much better, and called Joan.
The Barrington practice?
Hi, I'm going to be in D.C. overnight. I should be home around midday tomorrow. I'll give Fred an ETA in the morning, and he can meet me at Teterboro.
Okie doke.
Anything going on there?
Dino called and said he talked to the Virginia police, and not to call him until tomorrow. He's in meetings all day today.
Okay. See you tomorrow.
He hung up, then trudged upstairs and found the guest room. He stretched out on the bed, fully clothed, and pulled a quilt over him. As he did, his phone rang again.
Hello? Stone, it's Ed Eagle. How are you?
Just fine, Ed.
There's something you need to think about.
What's that?
You know the Dudleys from Dallas who have a place next door to you?
Never met them.
Well, they have 3 acres, a beautiful piece of land, with a house on it that's smaller than yours. They want to sell, and the price is right. If you combine the two, you'd have 5 gorgeous acres and a big guest house. Interested?
Ed, I don't have room in my brain for that right now, but I'll think about it.
Can I call you tomorrow?
Okay, but don't wait any longer or they'll give it to an agent to sell.
Thanks, Ed. Talk to you tomorrow.
Stone stared at the ceiling. He felt relief at having Mocker out of his way and regret over Marissa's decision. It didn't take long for him to convince himself that it was better this way. He drifted off into an untroubled sleep. 59. Stone entered the White House through the West Wing, was escorted upstairs to the family quarters by a Secret Service agent, and installed in the Lincoln bedroom. He freshened up, shook the wrinkles out of his blue blazer, and presented himself in the living room, where Kate and Will Lee and Holly were already on their first drink. A little boy was playing in front of the fireplace, and a glass of ice and a bottle of Knob Creek bourbon sat on the coffee table. All the domestic comforts. Will shook his hand, and Kate and Holly offered warm hugs and kisses. Then Will poured his drink.
"Good God," he said. "Is that your tiny baby?"
"Bill is 3 and a half now," Kate said. Stone had never picked up a child, so he just tousled his hair.
"Hello, Bill," he said. Bill ignored him.
"What have you been up to, Stone?" Kate asked.
"It would take me at least an hour to explain that," Stone said, "so I'll spare you."
"I assume you've heard about Holly's new job to come," she said.
"I heard a very interesting rumor," Stone replied.
"Well, it's true, but not for spreading around just yet. Even though we're ahead by double digits everywhere that matters, I don't want to appear overconfident by making new cabinet appointments before the election."
"I understand perfectly," he said.
Will spoke up.
"Before we get any drunker," he said, "there's something we want to talk to you about."
"Please do."
"The next 4 years are going to bring some important changes in our lives. In fact, they've already started. To begin with, our personal attorney, Kerwin Smith, is retiring, and his firm is merging with another, and we're not really going to know the people there anymore. Kate and I would be very pleased if you would become our personal attorney."
"Why, thank you, Will. I'd be delighted. You don't feel the need of a Washington lawyer?"
"In the long run, we won't be spending a lot of time in Washington after Kate's second term. We'll be making some big changes."
"What sort of changes?"
"To begin with, my mother died a few months ago."
"I saw the obituary, and I was sorry to hear it."
"Thank you for your kind note.
As a result, we've sold about 500 acres of her land and her herd of cattle, along with the mail-order steak business. We're auctioning her bulls, not wishing to stay in the bull semen business, and they're bringing big prices on the market. We're keeping the house and about 100 acres, and mine and Kate's presidential libraries will be built there. I've also sold Dad's and my law practice in Delano to our other partner.
Where are you going to live when you're free people again?
We've got the apartment at the Carlisle in New York, and we'll probably sell that and buy something on Fifth Avenue with a view of the park. Also, we want to buy a house in Santa Fe and spend a lot of time there.
As you say, lots of changes.
Kate's son, Peter Rule, has moved back from London, and he's working for New York Senator Saltonstall as his chief of staff. He's thinking of running for the other Senate seat at the midterm elections, as Senator Slade will be retiring.
Great idea.
I think he wants to be the new Ted Kennedy, Kate said.
What will you do with the Georgetown house? Stone asked.
Peter seems to think it's too much house for him, so unless he changes his mind, we'll sell it, I guess.
May I make a recommendation?
Of course.
Why don't you rent it to Holly with an option to buy?
We can't have a Secretary of State living over an antique shop on Pennsylvania Avenue.
What a good idea, Kate enthused.
I like that, too, Will said.
Is anybody going to ask me? Holly said. They ignored her.
Maybe later, Stone said. If Peter doesn't want to live there, I'll buy it and give it to the State Department as a permanent home for the Secretary of State.
I love it, Kate said. Actually, Peter already has a Georgetown house. When his father, Simon, died, he inherited that and everything else handed down by Simon's family, including a New York apartment and a place in the Hamptons and a pot of money.
Lucky boy.
Smart, too.
Something else, Stone said. As you know, I bought a house in Santa Fe a few months ago, and I think I went a house too far, since I can't spend much time there. It might suit your purposes very well. It has a nice master suite, a study, and a library where you and Will can work on your memoirs, plus four guest bedrooms, two of them in a guest house, all on about 2 acres. And I heard yesterday that the property next door, which is about 3 acres with a small house on it, is for sale. It might make a good headquarters for your Secret Service detail.
Well, Kate said, we're going to be in Santa Fe next week for a fundraiser. Why don't we take a look at it?
Better yet, Stone said, why don't you stay at the house? Ed Eagle can arrange for you to discreetly see the property next door.
Perhaps, Will said, we could do some sort of property swap. Your Santa Fe place for our Georgetown house.
That's an interesting idea, Stone said. I know your house, of course, but after you've been to Santa Fe, we can talk more about that. Also, a client of mine, Lawrence Haywood, bought a magnificent penthouse on Park Avenue with Central Park views, and I think he's bitten off more than he can chew. He has houses in Santa Fe, Palm Beach, and in England. Perhaps you could take a look at his penthouse.
Why not? Will said, and Kate was nodding furiously.
Something else you can do for us, Will said, reaching into a pocket and retrieving a loop-shaped piece of metal with a USB plug on one end. He handed it to Stone.
What's this? Stone asked.
It's a thumb drive containing Volume 1 of my memoirs, which runs from my birth in Georgia to Kate's election as president. I've been working on it for 3 years, and I'd like you to find me a publisher and make a deal.
I'll look forward to reading it, Stone said, slipping the device into his pocket. We could make the deal even more attractive if we include Kate's memoirs.
What a good idea, Kate said.
And, of course, I could also offer Holly's book.
Holly looked startled.
What book?
Your memoirs, dummy, Kate said. I'm writing my memoirs?
Trust me, Stone said. It will be a great read. Holly shrugged.
Okay, I'm in.
Suddenly I'm a literary agent, Stone said.
You'll be a great one, Will replied.
I'll bring in my team at Woodman and Well to handle your legal matters, Stone said. I already have sort of a firm within the firm that handles a couple of other clients' accounts.
A butler appeared and called them to dinner. This is wonderful, Kate said. All our problems solved before dinner.
We do what we can, Stone said.
60. Stone and Holly lay entwined in Lincoln's bed, or at least a reasonable facsimile.
Things are moving fast, aren't they? She said.
Blindingly fast, Stone replied.
Thank you for suggesting I rent Will and Kate's house. It's a wonderful place, and I'll have space to entertain after I take office.
We'll find a way for you to live there as long as you're in Washington.
Am I going somewhere else after I'm booted out of Foggy Bottom?
We can think about that some more. We've talked about it, if you remember.
I can't make any decisions now. There's too much ahead.
Neither can I. So we'll both have lots of time to think about it.
You'll come and visit, won't you?
Do you think we can get away with shacking up in Georgetown while you're Secretary of State?
I think we should find out, she said.
I think we should run that by Will and Kate, but not until after the election.
Fair enough.
Are you sleepy yet?
No. Do you want to do it again so soon?
Well, sure. But I want to tell you about the past few weeks. A lot has happened.
Shoot.
Stone began with St. Clair's attempted takeover of the Carlson Clinic, omitting details of Marissa, and continued until the present day. There, he said. Now you're all caught up with me. Holly replied with a small snore. Holly? Nothing. Stone freed his arm, which was getting numb, turned over, and fell asleep himself.
This is Tony Roberts. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Fast and Loose by Stuart Woods. This program was directed by John McElroy, executive producer Diane McKiernan. Text copyright 2017 by Stuart Woods. Production copyright 2017 Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.